There it goes.
One more time. Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome on this fine day to our Committee on Transportation and Economic Development this May 6, 2015. I think we have some very interesting things to listen to today, and I'm delighted you're all here in our committee room. We're going to change the order a little bit, and the first item on our agenda that we're going to address is golf, something very near and dear to my heart. And I would like to invite up Mr. Wolfsborn, Ms. Trammell, and Ms. Doyle, please. Thank you for joining us today. We're happy to have you here.
You bet.
You probably all don't know that my name is Caddy for a reason, do you?
I do know that story, but
yes,
I don't think these two.
Yes.
I'd like to hear the story.
Yeah.
Me too.
I was the third of a string of girls, and when I was born, my father, who played a significant amount of golf and still does, and he's in his 90s, my mother was quite disappointed that she hadn't produced a son that could caddy for my father. And she said, "Oh, I'm so sorry, you're not going to get your caddy." And my dad looked at her with a twinkle in his eye and said, "Yes, I did." And he named me Caddy. It's been all about golf in my household for 94 years.
Wonderful. That's wonderful.
I have my father's 1943 Letterman sweater from the University of Oregon downstairs in my car.
That's cool.
Anyway, so I'm very interested to hear what you have to say today.
Well, thank you.
In any particular order.
Well, thank you for having us. I'll start off, Madam Chair and representatives. Again, thank you for having us speak to you today about the golf industry in general. My name is Barb Trammell. I'm the CEO of the Oregon Golf Association and also a member of the Golf Alliance of Oregon with my two colleagues with me today. And we formed the Golf Alliance of Oregon as a consortium of the five core organizations of golf in the state of Oregon back in the beginning of 2008, and made up of representatives of the Oregon Golf Course Owners Association, the Golf Course Superintendents Association, the Club Managers, the Oregon Chapter of the PGA, and the Oregon Golf Association. And again, our mission is to sort of speak with one voice for the golf industry. We recently completed an economic impact study in conjunction with Golf 2020 and through SRI International, which I've given all of you a copy of the summary report. The full report is about 30 pages long. But also in conjunction with that report, we produced a golf scorecard, which you all saw this morning, I think, in session, and we put one on your desk, which sort of summarizes some of the highlights of the report in a handy format. And just a few of these items we'd like to speak to you today about. My background, just briefly, I've been in the golf administration and the golf industry for about 30 years. I moved to Oregon in 2007, took the position of the Oregon Golf Association CEO, and so I've kind of got a wide background in terms of golf in other areas and throughout the country. I would also like to introduce you to my left is Liz Doyle, who's the co-owner of Diamond Woods Golf Course and the Inn at Diamond Woods, and I'll let her speak to her background a little bit later. Next to Liz is Chuck Wolfsborn, who's the superintendent and general manager at Gresham Golf Course in Gresham, Oregon. They are, again, two members of the Golf Alliance, and we work very closely together promoting various initiatives. But the big one that we want to talk to you about is the economic impact study. Later on this afternoon, you are all invited, as I hope you should have received an invitation prior, to a reception that we're having at Illihee Hills Country Club at 5 o'clock this evening, where you can get to meet and talk to various representatives from the industry in all facets of the golf administration in the golf industry. So we hope you're able to attend that, and we've got some nice free drinks and hors d'oeuvres for you at the same time. So at first, I will turn it over to Liz, who's going to speak to the jobs portion of the economic impact study. Chuck will talk to the environment, and then I'll just finish up with a few words on the charitable contributions of the industry.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi. Welcome.
Thank you, and I'm very honored to be sitting here in front of all of you because I'm very thankful for the job that you guys do, and I just wanted to make sure you knew that.
Ma'am, would you mind identifying yourself for the record, please?
Yes, I will. I apologize. My name is Liz Doyle, and I am one of the owners of Diamond Woods Golf Course. That's in Lane County. Representative Lively has been a part of. I hope he knows who we are.
Yes, I do.
And and the inn of at the inn at Diamond Woods as well. My husband and I have built this with our brother. So I was a school teacher for about 20 years, and in the middle of that time, my husband decided it was important for us to build a golf course, and so I'm president of the Oregon Golf Course Owners Association, but I represent, as you'll see in your study, we have 190 golf courses in the state of Oregon, and about 220 of those are daily fee courses. But when it gets down to the what I would call the owner, mom and pop, or what you would say people like ourselves, we have about 112 of those. And that's what I want to sort of speak to as far as jobs go in that area. Right now, we are hiring high school students, we hire college grads, and we hire a lot of retired people. And we're at a position right now, and the thing that's been so exciting, I guess I should say, we have 21,000 jobs that we are so excited that we're part of for the state of Oregon. And it's very important that we provide a really good, affordable golfing opportunity for everybody in the state. And as an owner ourselves, it's also really important that we train up kids that are out of high school and that we help to train in new positions, people out of college, for example, for our golf course. We have one student that just graduated from Willamette University, and she really wants to learn some management because she's going to get her master's, and I put her in charge of food and beverage this year. Nice. But that's part of the opportunities we can provide at our facility, as well as having my gentleman in my mower is 78 years old, another guy behind my counter is 65, and I have another gentleman that's 72. So we have a full gamut at our golf course, and I think that's a nice thing about it. I think for the problem for the person, people like ourselves, that 112 course owners, it's been increasingly difficult financially to continue to offer the same amount of amenities and keep the same amount of people, because the cost of our be able to have people employed by us is becoming more difficult as prices are going up, and the cost to be able to have that employee behind our desk is getting to the point where, do we lay them off? No. Do we automate? Possibly, because it's getting more difficult for us to do certain things, and for a golf industry, you don't want to ever do that. It's part of what we do, but I think it's important to speak to, because the 21,000 jobs that this 112 daily fee courses add to, I think are getting to a point where it's becoming a critical point that we've got to have a chance for. We want to hire more. We want to be able to keep the people that we have, but it's getting more difficult to do that. I have to be very candid with you on that. It's getting more difficult on the daily fee level person to do that. It's just getting too expensive for us. And we don't want to have that happen again. And again, we're as business owners, that's what we do. We will take the position because that's what we can do, because that's what puts food on our table as well. But it's also a real true reflection of the people that I represent as golf course owners, the 112 courses. It's getting more difficult to do that. So still, bottom line, we're thrilled that we're producing that many jobs for the state. So it's a positive thing as well. So if you have any other questions, I'll switch it over to
great. Charles. I think we'll finish the panel and then we'll open for questions. Thank you so much for your testimony.
Well, thank you for that. I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
Welcome, sir.
Thank you. Madam Chair, committee members, I'm Chuck Walsborn. I'm a resident of Troutdale, Oregon, and superintendent and managing partner at Gresham Golf Course in Gresham, Oregon. The golf course was open in 1965, and so this is our 50th anniversary, and I've been there most of those years other than some time off for college and graduate school, so it's been my lifelong profession. The golf course industry has been proactive in the efforts of voluntary stewardship in programs such as Audubon International's Cooperative Sanctuary Program for Golf. The United States Golf Association, the Golf Course Superintendents Association of America, and local chapters have funded research in areas related to golf course management and its relationship to the environment. The industry continually makes efforts to use science as the foundation to benefit golf in the areas of turf grass and resource management, sustainable development, and environmental protection. In the year 2000, the Oregon Golf Course Superintendents Association created the Environmental Stewardship Guidelines and did so with sincere enthusiasm and passion for the environment and the industry. These have recently been updated and are used by many courses nationwide. While golf courses include both natural and altered landscapes, research is showing that golf courses are a benefit to wildlife. On our own course, in an urban setting, we have residing red-tailed hawks, coyote, and beaver. We have also been frequented by bald eagle, herons, Canada geese, and other migratory birds. Water is a key resource in the golf course operation, as well as a key impact area for the environment and the community. Golf courses are continually making efforts to reduce the amount of water that they require. Often this is done by computerized irrigation controls that will individually control a specific site, but it's also by changing turf grass species, reducing water to rough and other non-play areas. Years ago, it was common to see a golf course that had wall-to-wall irrigation. This is no longer the case, but becoming an outdated practice. Golf course superintendents utilize pesticides as part of a integrated pest management program to control pests and maintain healthy turf. Integrated pest management is a continuous system which diseases, weeds, and insects are identified, action thresholds are considered, all control options are evaluated, and controls are then implemented. Controls options could include cultural, manual, mechanical, biological, and chemical methods are being used to prevent and remedy unacceptable pest activity. Choice of a control options is based on effectiveness, environmental impact, site characteristics, work in public health and safety, and economics. The goal of the IPM system is to manage pests and the environment to balance the benefits of control, environmental quality, cost, public health, and specific site requirements. IPM takes advantage of all appropriate pest management options. For many years, golf has uniquely integrated nature and communities, providing environmental and social benefits, protecting coastal zones and urban greenscapes, improving air and water quality, employment, community, and a healthy intergenerational sports set in an ecological rich landscape. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much for your testimony, sir. Do you have questions for this panel?
Could I just speak to the charitable piece?
In fact, I was just reading about it in your document.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Davis has a question.
Thank you. My name again is Barb Trammell. I'd just like to speak, just to wrap up our testimony, with regards to the charitable contributions that the golf industry provides. You can see in your scorecard, overall charity is $31.8 million. And I think the big piece about this is not only are the larger events that are run in the state of Oregon, for instance, the LPGA Portland Classic every year, which has been an existence for over 40 years, generates over $1 million to various local charities every year. In fact, I think the Boys and Girls Clubs claim that over a 10-year span, they alone have received $3 million from that event alone. But aside from those big tournaments, the individual golf facilities themselves generate a great deal of thousands of dollars every year, not only in donated rounds of golf to local high schools, for instance, college tournaments, and such, but the hosting of charitable events throughout the year really adds up. I know Liz's facility, for instance, just I think it was last year, mm-hmm. raised over $300,000 mm-hmm. with 50 events over the course of the year, and that's just one facility in a rural area in Oregon. So if you think about all the numbers of facilities that we have across the state, all 190 facilities, that's a pretty good chunk of money that's raised through the golf industry, and so we're very proud of that. One other piece that I think, Caddy, you could probably relate to, which a lot of of people don't know about, but the Evans Scholar Foundation is, we are very supportive of that from the OGA standpoint in the Pacific Northwest. It is an opportunity for kids to get a full ride, a $40,000 scholarship to either Oregon or Oregon State, and currently I think we have 30 students between those two universities. And again, a great deal of money is raised through the Evans Cup of Oregon, which is conducted every year, but also through donations and through separate outside organizations that raise money through that foundation all year. So just another example of the effect of the golf industry as a whole impacting lives beyond just people going out on the golf course and enjoying the game for health and recreation. So thank you.
And Ms. Trammell, I appreciate you bringing that up. I was going to mention it had you not. I've been involved with the Chick Evans Scholarship for quite some time, and down in my particular area, we have a lot of students who caddy during the course of their high school career and have been able to take advantage of that amazing scholarship. I also have my dad actually played in a tournament up in Seattle with Chick Evans when Chick was in his 60s, and my dad was quite a bit younger.
Yeah.
And they had an amazing round that my dad is really tells some great stories about. But the legacy that he left for that caddy industry and now the high school kids that he is impacting is something that's actually quite remarkable.
Yeah.
And it's very nice to hear that that in Oregon it is becoming more widespread and having a tremendous impact.
It is.
Yeah.
Thank you. Again, thank you for giving us the opportunity to come.
Certainly. I think Vice Chair Davis had a question, and Representative Lively has a question.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you all for your testimony. I wonder where Oregon ranks. I didn't see it anywhere in the material here with the study. Nationally, and you can pick the measurement, number of courses, total impact on the economy. Where do we measure in relation to other states in the impact of golf? I mean, clearly we think of California, Arizona, Florida as probably the three top states, and maybe we're not there, but any idea?
You know, we actually don't have that information. There's a gentleman that's going to be at the reception this evening who worked for SRI International and conducted a lot of different economic impact studies using the similar template throughout the country and would probably have that information. I'm not privy to that, but I do know, yes, in areas like California, Florida, golf is a much bigger business. But I would suspect that we just, from a number standpoint, are on, you know, in the upper end of the scale in terms of overall the percentage of economic impact to the economy of a particular state. I do know, which an interesting statistic, I think, to all of us when we first did one of these about 5 years ago and it was just updated, is that the golf industry is very comparable to industries in Oregon, same amount or similar amounts of the economic impact to paper manufacturing, software publishing, and greenhouses and nurseries. And I think people think of that as huge industries in Oregon. Well, golf is very comparable to those same industries, which is something I think that surprised us when we did the study.
Follow up?
Yes.
Thanks for that. And in terms of, I mean, you're in front of the legislature right now in terms of legislation that could help the industry or harm the industry. What do you see out there this session?
Anyone want to comment?
I would be very honest and say that the minimum wage and sick leave and things that are costing us more to be able to have employees are forcing us to cut employees and honestly very seriously looking at automating and putting a kiosk up instead of having someone check in with a customer. As owners, there's a lot, like I said, I represent 112 of that, and we, you know, it's over half the golf courses. It's really, really affecting us. Over the last 7 years, the cost to be able to offer employees with other rising costs that go on in the industry and keep doing what we're doing and cutting back is really, it's really starting to affect us a lot. I know I can just say that personally is affecting us a lot. And I, again, as president, I represent a lot of other courses that way. But it's hurting us, and I think that's what we're concerned about because it's starting to change what's happening with our industry. Do we turn into a foot golf industry? Do we put it into a, do we change what we do, or do we do we change the way golf is? And it's really costing us to look hard at things that we just are discouraging because golf is a, as you know, is a game, and it's a completely different, we're not a park. So you asked a good question. I appreciate that, an opportunity to answer that, Representative Davis. Thank you.
I think another good way to look at golf is, to most people, the image of golf is, you know, through the PGA Tour or television. But I found out several years ago, according to the Department of Labor, 98% of all golf courses qualify as small business. So the golf industry is basically a small business industry. So, you know, you're dealing with, you know, small businesses like those of us here, and like our course was built by my father in 1965 and has been a family operation all these years.
Thank you. Representative Lively.
Thank you, Chairman McEwen. So the first question, and first, you have a beautiful course, and I've been on it multiple times. I didn't say played on it because some people don't think my golf classifies as playing golf, but it's great exercise.
It is great exercise.
one of the questions I have is about the potential growth or the opportunities, because I've read a lot in the papers, and I appreciate the comments you made about costs, and that certainly is something a big concern. But I know things are changing. People, younger people especially, have different approaches and attitudes. And so is there still an opportunity for growth in the golf business from the standpoint, or what do you do to reach out to both not just sustain it, but provide more opportunities? Because I think they're there.
Can I speak?
Yes, please. Go ahead.
You do too as well. Continue.
You go.
Okay. She knows a lot about that too. I know that for us, as far as increasing that, we're trying to do our best to do two things. We're trying to keep our costs down so we can make it more accessible to a lot of people. We're doing I'll give you an example, and there's a lot of courses doing that. We're doing Family Fun Night where golf for four, you've seen that, golf for four people with a cart, $25.
It's a great deal.
If you have a kid. Because we're working really, really hard to do that. And we all offer golf for free to the high schools. Mm-hmm. And we work really hard to try to be good partners with kids, because we need to keep, golf is a really, it's a sport of integrity and honesty. And if you know this first tee program that they ran in River Ridge, it's just really a great way to develop character in kids, as you know, for caddy. And we don't want to keep, we're concerned about losing the opportunity to keep that happening. And again, as a small business owner, I would say that, because we're not a corporately run. And like Chuck, we built our own golf course while I was a school teacher, so go figure, right? I'm crazy.
Yeah, and I think, too, as an example of something the OGA is doing, we're trying to reach out more so now to the younger generation than we were in the past, because we've realized, I mean, even our membership numbers have declined and decreased over the past 10 to 15 years, mm-hmm. as most state and regional golf associations have experienced the same thing. And what we're seeing is an older demographic, which is, quite frankly, dying off, and we're not seeing some of the young kids coming up. So one initiative we're doing here in Oregon through the OGA is a program called Youth on Course, which is a subsidy program that we do with some of our partners like the First Tee and Leisure Hour Golf, and kids will go online and take an etiquette course and a rules test, and then get a membership card.
That's good.
And with that membership card, we've secured right now about 25 facilities who have agreed to discount their fees to junior golfers with this card. The kids pay $5 to play an 18-hole round of golf. The OGA then subsidizes up to additional 10 to be able to compensate the facility up to $15 to play. So that's become, we just started that about 2 years ago. It's become very popular. Again, it's just kind of some outreach to figure out ways to get kids on golf courses that it's not so expensive.
If I might.
Certainly, and then we should probably be moving on. Thank you.
So I have a concern about safety on golf courses, and you might think that concern has to do with who I hit the ball towards. It doesn't.
No comment.
Okay, I was on your course one time playing, and it seemed like 100 miles away, but it was on the course, and there was this thunder and lightning storm, just the skies just opened up. And I didn't know if there was an evacuation route or what we were supposed to do out there in the middle, because you had trees, we could have got in there, but I've been told that's not a wise thing to do.
Mm-mm.
So what do you do?
So what we do, because we have Doppler radar running in our front desk, literally that's a big thing for us. So if we see anything coming, when you check in, we tell you something coming, we tell you what to do and where to go if that's going.
Okay.
Definitely get rid of your club.
Yeah.
Control your clubs.
Get your perfect pet heading into the hole.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank
well,
you.
I can tell you it's an industry that's very important in my district, and there's always growth occurring down on the South Coast. My father actually designed and built a golf course in the 60s also, so I've observed how those things occur, and I appreciate your good work. And the small golf courses are just as important as the big ones. And it's an industry that I think is a great thing for the state of Oregon. So thank you for your time today.
Thank you
for the opportunity. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Sure.
While we're waiting for Representative Nathanson, who should be here in just a moment, I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 628 and turn to Mr. Brennan.
Thank you, Madam.
We will briefly move this and then start on our next informational hearing.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 628 designates portion of U.S. Highway 395, currently known as the Pendleton-John Day Highway, as the Don Kendall Memorial Highway. We heard this on the 27th of April. Has no amendment to minimal fiscal impact, no revenue impact. The measure had a vote on the Senate floor of 30-0, Madam Chair.
All right. Vice Chair Davis.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 628 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Davis moves that the committee send Senate Bill 628 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk, will you call the roll, please?
Representative McClain.
Aye.
Representative Betts.
Aye.
Representative Pack.
Aye.
Representative Lively.
Aye.
Representative Davis.
Aye.
Representative Borsak.
Yes.
Representative McKeown.
Aye. The motion carries. And we need a carrier for this bill.
Member
who did this come from, Mr. Brennan? Do you know?
This was Representative Barreto. That's right.
Shall we assign it to Representative Barreto? Is everyone in agreement? Mm-hmm. All right. Representative Barreto will carry. Mayor Piercy, thank you so much for being here today. And if you'd like to come up and join us, I think Representative Nathanson's timing is impeccable.
Perfect.
All right. How did we do? We timed that just right. Thank you so much for being here to talk to us today about passenger rail. This is another topic, of course, that's near and dear to all of our hearts, and we're very pleased that you were willing to take the time to come and speak with us.
Thank you. Oh, go first.
Oh, thank you. Thank
I think
you.
You're on the clock, Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. I'm Nancy Nathanson, representative from House District 13. Some of you are already aware that I'm an advocate for rail. I've passed a couple of bills related to rail, like preserving rail right-of-way and codifying our interest in a bi-state agreement for planning and operations and funding of a passenger rail corridor with the state of Washington. I have also been participating in the Passenger Rail Leadership Council, for which Mayor Piercy is a chair, and I have been enjoying participating on that for a couple of years. I want to begin by reflecting briefly on the role of passenger rail and then talk for a couple of minutes about what role I think the legislature should play in supporting passenger rail. Maintaining passenger rail service in Oregon is vital to maintaining our investment in Oregon's economic future. It's a necessary component of our transportation system. It connects people from all over Oregon to schools, to work, to medical services, to events, to families. It's an environmentally friendly and safe mode of transportation. It supports land use goals, supports community development, and frankly, I can't imagine planning a transportation future without passenger rail being part of that. In fact, I don't think the rest of the country could imagine it either. We are one of the nation's designated high-speed rail corridors, and whether you're envisioning a bullet train or something just a little faster than an average of 45 miles an hour, we are one of the designated rail corridors in the country. The rest of the country looks to us and would be quite surprised if we did not continue to support passenger rail. Passenger rail reduces congestion on roadways. It offers a reliable and safer alternative to driving a car. It reduces greenhouse gas emissions from the transportation sector, and it provides tourism opportunities, and that's one piece of how rail plays into our economic future. Estimated tax revenue generated by travel spending from Amtrak Cascade passengers alone in the most recent year that was studied was $1.5 million, just for that one little piece. Ridership. Some of the people who use inner city trains have cars. They just find train travel preferable for work because you can make the most of your travel time. You can work while you're traveling, or you can take a nap. Nearly half of the train riders, however, don't have access to a car. Many of those are at the younger and the older ends of the spectrum. So at each of those two ends, some seniors, even those who do still drive, prefer to travel distances by train where possible. AARP has written a letter supporting investing in passenger rail. Students and youth make up a disproportionate amount of the ridership. Young people aren't getting a driver license at the rate that they used to. In 1999, 34,000 teen licenses were issued. In 2000, the first year of Oregon's new teen driver policy, it dropped to 29,000 for that year. It's been declining since then, varying between 23,000 and 27,000 a year. Last year, it was 26,000. That's from 1999, when it was 34,000. Yet, as a proportion of the population, it's very significant. Trains are connecting young people to jobs and to school. Amtrak ridership has increased from 1995 to 2013 by 255%. In the last 6 years of that period, it increased 45%. That's a significant increase. So what do I think the legislature should be focusing on? Two things: funding for passenger rail and improving service. On funding, we have made an investment in passenger rail. We purchased trains, we support operations, and we have supported improvements. I support the $10.4 million budget, $10.4 million budget that ODOT had identified as necessary for continuing passenger rail support. The 70-member Oregon Transportation Forum, with members ranging from the Coos-Siskiyou Shippers and Association of General Contractors to Oregon Trucking Association, vehicle dealers, and AAA, all support investment in trains. We shouldn't abandon this part of our transportation future and this part of our network. Improving service is important as well. There's a House bill now being considered in the Senate that directs ODOT to work on even further increasing ridership and boosting tourism and increasing revenue through improving on-time performance, improving schedules, and through other means. The bill specifically directs ODOT to look at targeted infrastructure investments. For example, how would we eliminate choke points? Should we construct separated grade crossings to increase safety and speed? Should we add parallel tracks or sidings to reduce congestion-related delays? Rail is not about the past. It's not just a quaint memory. Rail is now. We should be investing in this as a part of our future, for freight and for passenger. Statistics support this. Land use and environmental goals demand it. And I believe our economy requires it. I think passenger rail is and should be a significant part of our investment. And I want to leave you with a view of something that I can send you if you don't already have access to it. There's a pie chart that I received on funding, ODOT's funding for rail. There's a really tiny sliver that I shaded in orange here. That teeny weeny sliver is our support for rail as compared to driver and motor vehicles, motor carrier programs, highway, infrastructure bank, central services, safety, debt service, and other modes, such as public transit and so forth. This little tiny sliver is our investment in rail. On a different chart that was prepared by Amtrak, this shows our federal investment in transportation by mode. There's a really thick slice here. The dark blue at the top, as you might expect, is highway support. The next one down, lighter blue, is support for air. There's a yellow band here, which is transit, and the little sliver that's barely visible at the bottom is rail. It's not a lot compared to everything else that we support, but I believe it should be part of now and part of the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. And Patrick, are those in Olas? Can we?
I don't believe so, but I can.
Would you mind if we took copies of those and put them up on Olas? That'd be great.
Madam Chair, I will make sure to give these to the committee administrator.
Thank you so much. Mayor Piercy, it's an honor to have you here today.
Thank you so much. I appreciate being asked. Good afternoon, Chair McGowan and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kitty Piercy, Mayor of Eugene. I'm here today to talk with you about our passenger rail system, its importance to the economic well-being of our state and Eugene, both now and in the future. You see in this first slide the high-speed rail corridor. that Representative Nathanson talked about, the designation in this country. They are relatively limited, and we are fortunate to be the home of a spectacular rail corridor, Cascadia, that runs from Eugene to Vancouver, British Columbia. Current ridership on the Cascade Corridor between Seattle and Eugene is growing, but is hampered by lack of passenger train priority and by speed limits on the existing rail infrastructure. Our corridor is unique in that it is owned by freight rail companies and is a shared line. Cascades is Amtrak's eighth busiest route and carries the most passengers of any Amtrak route outside of California and the northeastern U.S. As this committee is aware, funding for Amtrak operations has been shifted from federally supported to state supported. Our Oregon section is unique in that the only dedicated funds we have to support our passenger rail are, da-dum, vanity license plates and lawnmower fuel. In 2008, the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, ARRA, was passed, which made available high-speed intercity passenger rail funds to deliver critical rail infrastructure improvements that would expand travel choices and foster economic growth across our nation. Washington State has completed a statewide rail plan and was eligible to receive these funds, beginning planning on over $300 million in rail investments on 20 high-speed rail projects, including work on the Washington Cascade Corridor. When federal dollars became available to provide a high level of support to high-speed rail, Oregon was unable to qualify because we did not have an up-to-date state rail plan in place. Governor Kitzhaber created the Rail Leadership Council that we serve on, made up primarily of elected officials from the Willamette Valley. The committee was charged with advising the governor and the Oregon Transportation Commission on a preferred alignment for intercity passenger rail improvements. The recommended improvements will become a foundation for the future to make Oregon more competitive in finding funding for future products to our freight and passenger rail service in Oregon. You see on this slide the list of the variety of people who are serving on our Leadership Council, and I'm pleased to co-chair this committee along with John Russell from Portland. As you can see, the membership includes current and former legislators. ODOT has been working hard to move ahead and to do what we need to do to get federal funding and choose a path forward. We've got a state rail plan in place, the alignment study, and future plans, and I have served on all of them. We are studying options for improved passenger rail service between Eugene Springfield and Portland, a 125-mile segment. This segment is part of the federally designated Pacific Northwest Rail Corridor. While the planning work has been moving ahead, there have been also significant economic investments in passenger rail. ODOT invested $36.6 million in American Recovery and Reinvestment Act funding to purchase two new train sets, very good-looking ones, for Cascade service, an investment that would be lost if the Cascade service goes away. Investing in our stations, both Albany and Salem have been seen significant investments in preserving and enhancing their stations. Significant improvements were also made with ARRA funds to Portland's Union Station. The state of Oregon and the city of Eugene have invested in making the Eugene Depot an excellent southern terminus for Amtrak Cascade's passenger rail service. Eugene Depot was built in 1908. In 2004, there were $4.5 million was invested, including $3.5 million in federal transportation funding, and it was spent on restoring this historic train station. Subsequent to that, additional improvements have been made to the facility, including improved vehicular and pedestrian circulation and improved parking. It's good looking. In 2011, the city of Eugene received $1.5 million for planning and design of a layover facility that will add much-needed capacity for increased passenger and freight rail service. These funds were part of the ARRA funds for rail development. The plan improvements will include rail spurs and a crossover to permit trains stopped in Eugene to be parked off the main line, as well as a passenger platform serving rail passengers. The goals of this project are to provide a safer rail passenger platform facility with a dedicated passenger area for safe boarding and waiting, to allow for staging of trains, to provide more rail capacity, and to kind of make that clog between the freight and the passenger rail go away to some degree, and give access to the main line without passing near the station. The city and partners are enhancing multimodal transportation options that connect to this Cascades train service. Eugene's new bike share system will include a station at the Eugene Depot. The West Eugene Amex extension includes a new bus rapid transit station within four blocks of the depot. The city has made pedestrian and bicycle safety improvements to the Fifth Street Avenue corridor, which is less than a block from the station. And we have Railgate. Amtrak has been a partner with the University of Oregon and ODOT in providing a transportation connection from the north for Duck football. That sounds like fun, and it is, but it's really about dollars. This significantly reduces I-5 traffic on game days, improves safety, and reduces automobile trips on our road system. It's a win in about every way you can think of. The Amtrak station is a starting point of Willamette Street, our community's main street. It is also right by Fifth Avenue, which will connect the downtown riverfront to the east with all the vitality and economic activity of the Whitaker neighborhood to the west. There have been $300 million in investment in the last 5 years, and an additional $300 million investment is either planned or underway, a significant sign of economic recovery and opportunity that is linked to our rail service. The City of Eugene and our regional partners are committed to reducing the share of trips made by single-occupancy driving. Having robust train service between Eugene and Vancouver, BC, is a critical element in reducing driving for longer inner-city trips. We are working hard to rebuild, revitalize, and recreate our downtown, including the historic core and riverfront. Amtrak service is a critical part of our regional access and our local and regional economic development strategy. And what works for us works for Oregon. In 2021, people will come from around the world to Eugene for the 2021 World Track and Field World Championship, the first time it's been in this nation. We want them to see amazing athletes and enjoy what our community has to offer. We want them to come by Amtrak. Amtrak will continue to play a vital role in connecting our city with the rest of the Cascade Corridor and the Pacific Northwest, hopefully well into the future. And this includes good connections and important economic connections to the coast, south, and east. Please join me in supporting our economic, transportation, and cultural goals with continued funding of the Amtrak Cascade service. Trains mean more, help move people and the economy and contribute to a healthier Oregon, opportunity, access, safety, all those things we all work for all the time. In closing, Amtrak service is a critical part of our regional access and our local and regional economic development strategy, and our state has made significant investments. We need the legislature, you, to invest in maintaining passenger rail now in and into the future. We need to develop a long-term funding strategy and resolve passenger and freight conflicts. We need to commit and invest in our state rail plans for both the short and the long-term vision of our state. And we need to raise the bar on increasing rail accessibility. Rail needs to be easy, affordable, reliable, with good multimodal connections for business, everyday passengers, special events, and international tourism. We have growing numbers of international students in our area that bring with them great potential for the use of passenger rail. So, I hope you're as excited about what this promises for us. And I only would add, and it's not in my notes here, but I just would add that I think we're all very conscious that you all want data. You all want to see benchmarks. You want to see us hitting them and building a rail system that is reliable and responsible and really can create a wonderful future for this state. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Mayor Piercy.
Madam Chair, are we asking questions now or are we waiting?
Should we finish the panel?
Sure. Whatever you like.
I think you're on a time frame, so.
No, actually, I'm just here to support the mayor with the PowerPoint.
Oh, okay. All right.
Madam Chair?
Yes, ma'am.
If I might, there's something that we haven't mentioned yet that I hope that someone, there are additional panelists behind us, is that right? Mm-hmm. I hope that someone else will explain to you a little bit more about how passenger rail is timed to connect, the schedules are timed to connect with bus routes in the point service that are connecting different regions of the state. So this really, even though we're talking about passenger rail in the Cascadia Corridor, which generally means the Willamette Valley. It's time to connect different regions of the state, and you will recognize some of these service areas where ODOT has worked very carefully to time the bus and train connections to get people where they need to go. In the Northwest region, it's Astoria, Seaside, and Cannon Beach. In Central and Eastern Oregon, it's Chemult, Bend, and Redmond, Burns, Vail, and Ontario. And connecting Southern Oregon, Klamath Falls, Medford, Ashland, Grants Pass, Cave Junction, and Brookings. So even though this specific discussion is about a Willamette Valley corridor, the train service itself is part of a multimodal transportation network that ODOT is managing.
It lifts all boats, if I might say.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Thank you very much. I believe Vice Chair Gorsuch has a question, if you don't mind.
Yeah, I have a couple of questions, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. That's all right. First question, I've noticed at Vancouver, I've noticed at Oregon City, that the local bus service does not interface with the train stations. And it would seem to me that I would hope at least that we are considering talking to all of these transit districts, because that seems to me to be a substantially important connection. In the Vancouver case, you actually have to walk quite a number of blocks to access a bus.
I think you make a representative, of course, I think you make a really good point. And as we talk to people up and down our corridor in all the communities, that was one of their major concerns was, how is it going to connect? How are we going to make it easy for people to be able to use rail and connect to home or wherever they have to go? So that certainly is on the top of our list of what it takes to build a good system.
And follow up?
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The second piece, it would seem to me that to if we're going, and I know that there have been different corridors that we've studied, but it seems to me that if we're going to stick with the current corridor, which is Union Pacific, that's going to entail, I would think, some public-private work, because UP has a substantial freight service. And we know that one of the problems south of Portland is single track in a lot of places. Is that being considered in terms of
these folks that are coming next will talk to you
okay.
more about this.
All right.
Next panel.
Yeah. But one too soon.
But I actually wanted to say to you that, again, this is part of the conversation we had, especially with the state rail plan about public and private and how we try to use all the resources we have to leverage this corridor. So we're certainly thinking along the lines that you're talking about. Thank you.
And one line, and then I'll shut up. The one corridor that I have a question about, because I know, and actually I've been much more impressed by the bus service connecting to Amtrak in Oregon than in Washington State. But the one corridor, do we have a connection that follows the old Pioneer from Ontario, Baker City, Pendleton, Hood River, the Dalles, and into Portland?
I think you're going to save that question.
Okay, very good. All right, thank you.
Vice Chair Davis.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you both very much for your testimony. Seeing as how you're before a policy committee, I just am wondering if you can give policy justification for, I think this would, the ask is for general fund dollars, for passenger rail. And I ask it in the context of we're essentially a user fee system as it relates to our highway and our roads. When it comes to transit, although there is some state funding there on the capital side through Connect, you know, it's largely through employer assessments and through through tickets. So those are two modes that are largely funded through user fees or beneficiary fees in the case of employers. So what is the justification here for asking for general fund dollars for a mode of transportation, whereas all the others, or many others, are largely user fee based?
Sure.
And I'll add to that the local question of, is the county or the city making any investment in this?
So, Representative Davis, my answer to that, and probably others that come after me will give you more complete answers, but my answer to that is I think if you looked at the subsidy level for almost every form of transportation, you would find it considerable. So, certainly, I know transit system user fees pay only a small portion of it. They have to find other ways to do it. The same thing with gas taxes and road bonds and all of those creative ways that people go about keeping the rest of our infrastructure working.
Well, I mean, just to correct you, I mean, we are essentially fully user fee paid for our road system in Oregon. I mean, we don't subsidize it to the general fund except to the tune of a very, very, very minimal amounts, which is my question.
So you don't consider a gas tax, Representative Davis, you don't consider a gas tax any kind of subsidy?
It's a user fee. Those who use the system pay into the gas tax and get the direct benefit. A general fund, you're asking for income tax dollars, essentially.
So I suppose this would, excuse me, Representative Davis, I suppose we could have a long discussion about this. I think when you talk about the investments in road infrastructure and all of those things, they're all part of how you build a system to provide a way for many forms of transportation to work. But I do agree with you totally that the fees that we have in place right now, the lawnmower fee and the vanity license plate, will not cut it. And so I really think that we really have to have a very big conversation as a state about how will we go about doing this and what's the way we're going to do it. We can look to Washington. They've been working in how they pay for their part of the route for a long time. So there's lessons to be learned, but we have to get on it and figure it out. We have historically been totally reliant on federal dollars, and there's a shift. And so it's incumbent upon us to find a new path to be able to provide this valuable service for the people of our state.
And one quick follow-up?
Yes.
Thank you. Thanks for that.
Yeah,
and then the question of the local investment, in what ways has Eugene contributed?
And I think it's incumbent on us. I think we, Representative Davis, I have to remember the protocol here.
You're doing fine.
I used to be on the other side.
That's so right.
I understand. What I would say about that is that the question that's coming is how much are the local communities going to find a way to invest in it, too? So that's part of the discussion we need to have. But I would also say we're all working right now on all those kind of connections to it to create a seamless system. So we put already a terrific amount of energy into trying to connect our rail service to the other modes in our community. And that's something we're already very much invested in.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Thank you, Mayor. Any further questions?
Thank you so much.
I would comment that I spent a considerable amount of time some years back sitting on a rail funding task force that was looking for ways that we could find an ongoing, reliable source of funding for our rail assets. And it's very, very difficult. And it is a serious conversation, and it is something that we need to continue to have. So I appreciate you being here today.
And if I may, I would also say that part of this has to be, if you invest this, what's coming out the other side. So we have to have a conversation about where we'll get what we need to put in, what will that get us, and how will we benefit, and what makes that a good investment for us to make. And I think that's a very good conversation for us to have. Thank you so much for the time.
Thank you for being here. We appreciate it very much. At this time,
I would like to call Mr. Lang, Mr. Pate, and Mr. Gard, please. Oh, I'm sorry.
This is correct. I just want to make
sure. All right. We've had a couple of changes, so I hope everyone's here who would like to speak. Welcome to our committee.
Chair McEwen, thank you very much. For the record, my name is Hal Gard. I am the administrator of the Rail and Public Transit Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. And I have with me Mr. Ray Lang, representative from Amtrak out of Chicago. And I have with me Ron Pate, who is the Amtrak Cascades Corridor Director with the Washington Department of Transportation. And with your permission, I would like to turn the microphone over to Mr. Lang to start the presentation.
That would be just fine. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Madam Chairman and members of the committee. It's really a pleasure to be here in Salem today, as Hal said. My name's Ray Lang, and I'm the Senior Director of State Government Affairs for Amtrak, based out of Union Station in Chicago, Illinois. But it is a pleasure to be all the way out here and in front of you today, really, is to talk about this important service. This is, as one of the previous panelists said, it's one of our prized corridors, and it's one of the corridors that we hold up in very high regard when we talk about corridor development around the United States. Just as an aside, Madam Chair, I would say my father is 87 years old and golfs three times a week. and I'm the only boy.
My regards, please.
I have four sisters. I'm the only boy, so I was the caddy. So.
You got the job. Congratulations.
Yes.
Oh, and mine was pre-Title IX. It didn't work that way.
Earlier today, I had a chance to look at some of the other prepared remarks of the other panelists on this panel, and I fear that we're going to be a little bit duplicative. So I think I'm going to sort of hopscotch around my remarks a little bit. There we go. I'll talk a little bit about what's on each slide here, but I'm going to try and sort of set a picture for you about Amtrak nationally, and then turn it over to the other panelists to talk more specifically about the Cascades. But here, in a nutshell, is what the Cascade service sort of looks like on a daily basis: four daily round trips between Portland and Seattle. Two of those go north to Vancouver, British Columbia. Two daily round trips go south to Eugene, as you know. And this is a partnership, really, between Washington DOT, Oregon DOT, and the two freight carriers, BNSF and Union Pacific, over which we operate. I think what I'd like you to notice on this slide is the graph, the circular graph there on the bottom left-hand side. The previous panel, Representative Nathan, I believe, talked about how trains reduce traffic on roads and traffic congestion, highway congestion, and that's true. But one of the things that we like to talk about at Amtrak is the role that trains have in penetrating corridors around the country, and particularly the penetration we have in air rail markets around the United States. And in this corridor, you see we have, with the Cascade service, about 62% of the air rail market. And this corridor, the passenger train service that we're talking about today, really started in 1992. So in just 20 short years, 23 years, we're at the point now where the overwhelming majority of passengers that travel between Portland and Seattle each day take the train. They don't fly. And we see this around the country. We really do. Amtrak is a unique entity, and there's not really another entity quite like us. We are a government-owned corporation. We're different than the post office or Fannie and Freddie or the FDIC or something like that. We're structured as a corporation. We actually have stock. It's held by the Secretary of Transportation in Washington, D.C. But we are a corporation. The Supreme Court just ruled within the last about 6 weeks on a 9-0 ruling that we're actually part of the government, that provided some clarity in the whether we're privately owned by the government or publicly owned by the government. But we're by a 9-0 ruling, we're considered part of the government, but we're just unique. We have a board of directors. Our board members are nominated by the President of the United States. They're subject to Senate confirmation, and then once they're on the board, they're independent. They choose the management team. They raise their right hand, and they have a fiduciary responsibility to the books of the place and make sure it's run as a business. And as a corporation, we really do three different things. Those of you who've traveled extensively in the Northeast know that we own the Northeast Corridor between Boston, New York, and Washington, D.C. We own the railroad there. It's an electrified railroad overhead electrical catenary system. We run the high-speed Acela trains. You saw a picture of one of those earlier, which travel as fast as 150 miles per hour. And on the Northeast Corridor, we've really dominated the transportation market. We have about 76% of the air rail market between New York City and Washington, D.C., which is the number one transportation market in the United States. And we're at about 60% between Boston and New York. But that's different. Outside of the Northeast Corridor, we operate on the nation's privately held freight railroads. When we were created in 1971 by an act of Congress, the Congress gave us some pretty unique access rights to access the privately held freight carriers at an incremental cost, meaning what it cost them to have us operate trains there. And those rights are very, very valuable, and that's they're valuable to states, and that's why you as a state partner with Amtrak for this service. We run a series of overnight long-distance trains around the United States, and those are the ones I think most of the people in the United States think about when they think about riding on an Amtrak train. They imagine themselves in a sleeping car, having dinner in a dining car. They really do capture the public's imagination. But there's only 15 of those long-distance trains left in the United States. Really, outside of the Northeast, most of what we do is run corridor services in partnership with state governments like we do here on the Cascade service. And as I said, it's valuable to states to contract with us because of our very unique access rights to access the privately held freight carriers, and that's really what we're here to talk about today. That relationship between Amtrak and the states has changed over the years, but it's really it's a good relationship, and it's been codified in law, if you will, by Congress. Our authorization bill, the PREA bill, which was passed in 2008, really spells out the parameters of how Amtrak and the states interact with each other and what states pay for. Essentially, you pay the direct cost of those services. You pay an equipment charge for the equipment you use, and you pay a small share of Amtrak's overhead. And that was an act of Congress that really did that. Prior to that act of Congress, we had just sort of a hodgepodge of relationships with state governments around the United States, you being one of the older partnerships that we've had. In truth, there are 19 states now which pay us to run trains, and it is really the fastest growing part of Amtrak's business is the state partnerships. States pay us to run corridor trains and over short distances all over the United States, and as I said, there's 19 of them, and really what they're doing is what you're doing here, is they're taking short distance corridors and they're growing them by adding additional frequencies, they're buying new equipment, and they're making investments in the infrastructure to lower trip time. This is, in a nutshell, a picture of what our ridership is like on the trains that are not in the Northeast Corridor. You'll see we have short-distance corridors and long-distance corridors, and both of them had significant ridership gains up until about 2013. You can see on the short-distance corridors, the state partnerships, you see where I said it's the fastest-growing part of the Amtrak business. You see that in 1998, we were under 8 million passengers a year on state-supported trains. Now we're 15 million passengers a year on state-supported trains. You'll see that in 2013, we saw for the first time in a while a declining ridership trend on those trains. Looks like you want to
clarify something. Are these national numbers or statewide numbers?
Those are national numbers on this page.
Thank you.
At the end of 2013, last year in 2014, we noticed significant downturn in our on-time performance on everything off of the Northeast Corridor. And this was largely the result of the improving American economy and what that did to the nation's freight carriers. You've heard a lot about the oil trains that are sort of out there everywhere now, and that's true. There are lots of oil trains out there now. And you know, in North Dakota, where the Empire Builder goes, we really, really struggled last year to get trains through that area of the state. But, you know, we experience those problems everywhere. And it's not just oil trains, though. It's other trains. I mean, it's the intermodal trains that are running all over the country, too, that are really clogging up the roads. And on-time performance has an immediate impact on our ridership. It really does, because people want to start using trains frequently. If they're late by any stretch of time, they'll have a bad experience. And that's why we think our ridership began to decline slightly on both the short-distance and long-distance network last year. You saw that same trend here. There's two graphs here. You'll see the Cascades. We can sort of break out the Cascades into two different sectors. There's the Cascade service north of Portland and the Cascade service south of Portland. You see, in 2012, we really maxed out at about 850,000. My eyes aren't great, but I think it was about 850,000 on the Cascades corridors. And then we had slight declines beginning in 2013 and 14, and then moving forward, the Portland South section did not have a ridership decline during those years until last year, because last year we implemented a schedule change in partnership with the states in an attempt, I think, and we'll talk more about this, but in an attempt to begin to capture some southbound traffic out of Portland. I think we all agree that it wasn't successful because we've had declining ridership as a result of that, and we're working now with the states to change that schedule and try and get a more friendly schedule to recapture that ridership. And I know that we're going to be talking about that as we move forward. I want to talk a little bit about how we're funded. I know that some of the previous witnesses talked about the really small share of federal funding, which is available for states around the country. You see, in 2004, Our operating support, and Amtrak gets operating dollars and capital dollars at the federal level, but our operating support was about $950 million. It is now, in 2014, it is about $350 million. It has dropped significantly over the last decade. And you know, it's a good story for us to tell, in truth, because we cover about 93% of our operating costs. And if you, some of it is real estate holdings and things like that, but if you took that out and you just focused on ticket revenue, our ticket revenue is about 76% of our operating costs nationwide. All services are different, but we cover about 76% of our operating costs through the fare box and then make up the rest, up to 93%, through other revenues.
Chair, may I ask a question about that?
Do you mind?
Sure.
Vice Chair Davis.
Thank you. And what source of federal funds does that come from?
General revenue.
General revenue.
General revenue, yeah. We're not funded out of gas tax or anything like that.
And I don't think you need to be that close to the microphone. It's getting a little distorted up here.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Thanks. About
that. As I talked about, in 2008, Congress passed the current Amtrak authorizing legislation. They reauthorize us every 5 or 6 years or so. In 2008, the Passenger Rail Investment and Improvement Act, otherwise known as PREA, was adopted. And that changed the relationships between Amtrak and state governments around the country. And it really put a lot of the decision-making process in the state's hands, but it really also passed on a lot of the funding responsibilities for short-distance corridor trains to the states. And it actually specifically says any train which travels under 750 miles in length has to be funded by a state or it goes away. And this was a significant development because there were trains that we inherited the day we were founded in 1971, which we had always funded out of our federal appropriation. And those were at great risk because of this provision. And fortunately, amazingly, actually, none of the trains went away. The deadline was October 1st of 2013, and it really impacted states in the Northeast, like New York State, Connecticut, states that had New York had service to Albany and Buffalo that they had to pick up. They had to go from about $3 million a year for one train that they funded to about $45 million a year. It was a really significant hurdle for them. And we were really worried about that, but the states stepped up because states, I think, have made the decision that intercity passenger rail is a good thing to fund. Oregon had a partnership with us long before the PREA Act was passed, and it didn't really change Oregon's cost as much as it did for a state like New York. This is the economic impact of Amtrak in Oregon. You'll see in FY14, we spent $4.3 million in the state. We employ 81 people in the state, and they earn about $5.8 million. And those employees paid almost $400,000 in taxes. The most recent data on tourism spending from our passengers that we've studied is about $3.4 million a year. And then total related Amtrak spending, including the economic impact, we estimated to be about $31 million. That was based on a study we did. We've been asked by states for a long time to look at beyond just what our employees earn and what we spend, but what the economic impact is. And we said, well, it's not really something we should study. And then when so many states asked us to do it, we decided to do this. And it produced the jobs number there at the bottom, and it's about 480 ancillary jobs, and the economic development number of about $31 million. As I said, we're going to be working with the state to look at a schedule change to try and reverse the ridership trend. I'm very optimistic about that. I really am. And there will be some capital improvements coming to the infrastructure here in Oregon, which we think will begin to help us reduce some of the operating numbers. Capital investment does really generally produce reduction in operating cost if you target it right. And those are the kinds of investments we're making. And we're working on some marketing initiatives, some of which you saw in the previous slide about football trains and things like that, to attract a new group of passengers. So you know, there's a shortfall that you're facing in the biennial budget here of about $10.4 million. And, you know, we would obviously support full funding for this service. The parameters of the federal legislation are simply that if states don't pay for it, they go away. I mean, in a nutshell, you can look at ways to reduce costs, but I don't think you're going to make up that kind of a shortfall in that short period of time. So with that, I'll end it, and I'm going to let them talk more specifically about the Cascade service itself.
Great. Thank you.
Want to do a presentation?
We can switch.
I'll move over there. All right, let me move around.
Thank you for being here.
Madam Chair and committee members, thanks so much for having me here today. It's always great weather when I come to Salem. So
of course it is.
It's raining up north, so happy to be here. My name is Ron Pate, for the record. I'm the Washington State Department of Transportation's rail director. I also serve as the rail director, the corridor director for our corridor. In a nutshell, what that means is my job to make sure we are all on the same page to get all the trains to get higher in revenue, ridership, and make a difference and connect to the public better. Keep focus on our program as a corridor at the federal level and both states level. So as a corridor working together, we're much more, we're in a greater position to get federal funding. So there'll be three areas I just want to cover here, and I don't want to take too much of your time. I want to give you a program overview. I want to talk about our corridor efforts as we're working together with Oregon and Washington. I think we've developed a great relationship. I also want to give you some information about what's going on in Washington. Everyone's always curious because we did receive those federal funds and we're delivering that program. I think most of you know it's a 467-mile corridor. It runs from Vancouver, British Columbia, all the way down to Eugene, Oregon. BNSF and UP own the tracks, South Portland, pretty much Union Pacific, as you're aware of. Amtrak operates the service currently today. We pay them for that access. I think he mentioned, Ray mentioned, that they have a unique agreement with the host railroads that right now, currently in our agreements, we pay them to provide that access. And then Talgo and Amtrak maintain the equipment for us. Currently, Washington owns three train sets, Amtrak owns two, and Oregon added two train sets recently, as you know. This slide is really a program milestone slide that I think it's really important. I'm not going to go read through the whole slide for you. As you know, Oregon started sponsoring some of this service back in 1995, and as the service is growing, you've added a stop in Oregon City. We added some service that went up to British Columbia. Then we ended up getting that federal funding, and the service grew from there. With all this stuff going on, I think Washington and Oregon DOTs both recognize we need to work this as a corridor to work together. There's planning needs. There's funding needs. How can we get to economies of scale where we can make this service work better? Funding responsibility changes. That was touched on with the Passenger Rail Investment Improvement Act of 2008. Those state corridors, which Oregon and Washington fits into, less than 750 miles. And we have to pay all those operating costs besides revenue. So the revenue goes back to credit us. We, the states, between us are absorbing about 20% of the costs that Amtrak was getting paid for by the federal government prior to that. I can say that Washington and Oregon are participating in national committees. There's committees that were set up as part of implementation of Section 209 of PREA. Those committees are a performance committee, an operating committee, and a capital equipment committee. We are very active on those committees. We have seen some positive results and cost reductions on some of those committees by working together. Two states working together at these committees are really a benefit, and I really appreciate the efforts of Oregon. Annual funding by annual ridership by funding partners. You can see this slide. If you notice, the key thing to notice here in 2013, the Amtrak funding went away. And we recognize as well, I think the schedule is mentioned as one of the problems with your ridership south of Portland. Hal and I have been talking about this for some time, and we are already working with Amtrak about that. There is a proposed schedule that we're going to be reviewing in the very near future. He can talk about details of that. Rail Cascades Corridor Rail Achievements. I'll just go right to our Memorandum of Understanding that we signed in 2012. That was a really big milestone for us to get the states on the same page and recognize the benefits of working together. We've developed a Corridor Management Work Plan, On-Time Performance Task Force, which I think in the last 2 months our on-time performance is up. And when on-time performance is up, we notice that ridership goes up. Amtrak's also part of that team working with those host railroads. Host railroads dispatch that service. If we can't get that priority and get those trains there on time, it doesn't help anybody. State rail plan coordination. We're working actively, probably daily, with Oregon on state rail plan coordination, what the next steps are. We're developing a fleet management plan. Part of that fleet management plan is going to include your two train sets. Oregon will have their fleet management plan, including our two train, our three train sets and Amtrak's too. I think it's really important that as we look at a corridor like this, that's where these economies of scale can come in. Can we move the fleet differently? Can we save costs? Can we reduce crew times? We've had all these conversations with Amtrak, and we're looking at ways to reduce those costs. Unified corridor benefits, partnering to overcome significant financial issues through joint participation. Those are those groups I was talking about. We have seen some very productive work. We've seen actually some good results in lowering some of those initial costs that were proposed. So I think Hal's team, I really appreciate his team working with us. They're not easy conversations implementing anything like this that comes down from the federal level, as you know, but everyone's professional and we're getting down to the bottom line of what we need to have to make the service run. We've defined our common set of goals. Our goals are also to reduce taxpayer subsidy. That's always a question for the service. You know, how much is a subsidy? We've got right now about a 59% fare box recovery. We use an industry standard to measure that. Someone had mentioned earlier about transit systems and bus services. That's usually about 20%. So we're better than that mark. So that's a good thing, and we want to continue to grow that. And then strengthen those partnerships with contractors and other federal agencies. We're very active with the Federal Railroad Administration as part of the service and sponsoring the service, also with Amtrak. I will share a little bit about what Washington's doing, because I know Hal's doing the same thing on his side with actions. And I wanted to just talk a little bit about our Rail Division Action Plan. It's very much aligned with what the action plan that Hal's working on. We have governor's strategic goals in Washington State that we support to improve our costs of our service, implement lean practices. We've been actively working with Amtrak on lean practices as well of how we can lower those costs. A very easy example is in like the bistro car service. What we've done out of Seattle, out of the Holgate facility with Kurt Laird, who's the division superintendent, what can we do differently on the bistro car to make sure people can get through it? And we're noticing long lines. The folks in Oregon, we're really noticing, we get reports daily when somebody's not on the train. Why can't we get these products to the people? They want to buy the products. How can we improve it? And we implemented a credit card solution. Amtrak was very active in that with us, and so now we don't have to wait for the Wi-Fi system to process the card. It gets held in the system, and so we can get people through the lines and increase that food and beverage revenue. Also, we want to manage other costs and maintain revenue. We certainly don't want to lose any revenue. And then implement service enhancements that will get us efficiency improvements. We're always looking for ways, a better way to skin the cat. You know, rail service is under a state system versus a national system. There's things we bring, unique things to the corridor. Portland's got some great attractions that people can go to. I'd like to think that Seattle has some, too. How can we leverage those attractions from both of our states to get people on those trains? Ongoing improvement strategies and goals. Again, maximize revenue, manage those costs and contracts. That really comes down right now in our crosshairs is those 209 costs. How can we better manage those costs? Expand marketing partnerships, private-public partnerships that anybody's willing to listen to us. We are working to try to get the ears of Microsoft to maybe have surface giveaways. I know south of the border, I'm a big fan of Stumptown Coffee. How can we get them to do something for us? And then plan for the future. I think I mentioned our fleet management plan, our service development plans that you guys are participating with us on to make sure we're all aligned. I want to talk a little bit about those projects that we're implementing with the federal funding. So it's $800 million of federal funds. Seven projects are complete, 10 are in construction, and three are still in design, coming out of design. We are on target to deliver that program in 2017. We have many meetings every day and quarterly with many people to make sure that we get that job done. Out of that program, we'll get two more round trips between Seattle and Portland, and we'll improve our on-time performance to 88%, and we'll get a 10-minute schedule reduction. And here's some rail project outcomes, congestion relief, safety upgrades and new equipment, and then station work. I won't go through every one of these, but these are the types of things when we negotiated our service outcomes to get that additional service and get that schedule reduction time and that on-time reliability that was required to get the funding and then get an outcome for it for the federal government and the funds. So we're pretty excited about it. We're certainly, as we're moving this forward, keeping very close touch with Oregon, because we certainly want them to be poised in the future to get federal funds. And FRA, the Federal Railroad Administration, is always very clear: if you are a corridor, if you have memorandums of understanding between the states and you're working towards the same goals, you're much more likely to get federal funds. And with that, I'd be happy to take any questions or whatever you would like for the agenda, Madam Chair.
Mr. Pete, would you mind going back to, I believe it's slide number 10. I'm intrigued by the large sums of money that ARRA is pouring into this corridor. Could you just touch on those the projects that have completed and the projects that are in design? I see them detailed out, but I can't read them very well.
Oh, the projects on the screen. Yes. Well, there's 20 projects up and down the corridor, and the main. So I like to put it like this: most of the work is improving the track structure from this level of track to run trains across to this level of track, a higher level, higher performance level for the trains. Plus, sidings, meaning a freight train can pull out of the way. We can go by station improvements. King Street Station was a huge retrofit program. It's a beautiful station. If you ever get a chance to go up there and see it, I'd really recommend it. Positive train control, Point Defiance Bypass. It's about a $100 million project for track and signal work, Point Defiance Bypass, which will bypass, if you're familiar with Washington State, the Ruston route around Point Defiance. Mm-hmm. That's where we get our time savings. Okay. Also, a new station at Freight House Square. So we're building that to multimodal connectivity hub in the city of Tacoma. So Tacoma's excited about that, and they're actually a very active partner in helping us develop that station.
So when you're talking about the track, is this new ballast, new ties, new rail?
New ballast, new ties, new rail.
So speed can be increased?
New signal systems, right. Speed can be increased or maintained consistently.
Okay, grade separations part of any of this?
No grade separations. So until you get to about 110 and pass is when you really are required for the grade separations.
Okay, all right.
That'd be the next phase.
Yes, Representative McLean.
Well, we're sharing the rail with freight, and you talked, I think in one of those improvements, you talked about a side rail, right, or a way to get some of the train off to the side so we can get somebody through. How much of the projects are dealing with that element of improvement?
Probably three or four of the projects are developing that or building that or extending that. Kelso Martin's Bluff is one that we're working on right now to try to get into construction that'll build that extra sidetrack. And it all comes down to, when I always look at this, BNSF in our corridor, UP for your corridor, they dispatch the traffic. And so once we build this, we want to make sure to hold them accountable to dispatch that traffic to make sure our trains are there on time. So they connect to people in Portland, so your trains connect. One of the schedule things I know we're looking at as part of that schedule change is how can we get through trains? The trains that go right through Portland pick up the people, so it's very consistent for your ridership and people that want to get on the trains.
Okay. I have one.
Yes, Vice Chair Gorsuch.
The one difference, though, between BNSF's section and UP section, a lot of BNSF is twin track already.
Between Seattle and Portland, yes.
Yeah.
North of Seattle, there's a lot of single track territory.
So, especially then between Portland and Seattle, that benefits the transit time, I would think.
It does.
And that's a problem for us south of
our Vancouver rail yard project. We built some extra tracks there too to get the trains out of the way on the rail yard. Up in Everett, we added tracks in a rail yard so the freight trains could get off the track and into the rail yard.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Lively.
Thank you, Chair. So I've ridden it a lot, gone to Vancouver and that. So I'm interested in the comparison of today of the speed or the average speed versus what it was a few years ago, because ultimately, from a standpoint of scheduling, that's what impacts a lot of people, whether they choose to ride the train or how long it takes to get from here to Seattle or here to Vancouver. And I know it's changed some. I know it's different in the two states.
Yeah, I think that average speed question is a tricky question, because if you look at overall, depending on the number of station stops, you could be down 40, 50 mile an hour average speed. Our speeds are supposed to be right about 79 miles an hour in most of the places. What we're trying to get to is consistency.
Okay.
And you also have to be careful when you're planning a corridor of station stops. Every time you stop that train, you're kind of bringing that speed down. And then to get back up to speed, it's fuel, it's more cost. So intercity passenger, major city to major city, and then using that commuter connection in between, that multimodal connectivity.
Thank you.
Any questions? I have a question for Mr. Lang, or any of you. I know you're modeling these all the time, and you know, we're not Boston to New York. So we just don't have the volume of population that the East Coast is going to have. Do you see a time in the future, or I know we need to incentivizing increase in ridership is important, but do you see a time in the future when we will, without an explosion in population, find that sweet spot where that ticket box is going to kind of help sustain the operations of this of Amtrak at some point in the future? I know something we struggle with every day that we have to continue to talk about, but what do you see in our future?
That's a tricky question, too, but I will tell you that the corridor, which we own, and you're right, it's you know, the number one transportation market in the country. The corridor covers all of its operating costs, and it produces a surplus, but it doesn't come close to covering its cost of capital. Mm-hmm. And we get dollars in two ways. We get operating and capital dollars. So I guess, to be honest with you, I mean, I think you can get to the point where your service covers its operating costs. It's going to take capital investment, and I think you're always going to have to make capital investments in the infrastructure. One of the things that Mr. Pate was talking about, and your questions were good ones, about trip time, those are good things to know, because you want to have a very competitive trip time with the automobile and with the airplane. But the other part of what Washington State is doing is adding frequencies, and so much of their capital investment is buying capacity, if you will, on the railroad so you can get more frequencies. And for you to get to the situation where your fare box is going to cover your operating costs, you're probably going to have more frequencies. And that's just going to cost capital. And so, I mean, I think you should always be prepared for that, you know, to get to the sweet spot that you want, there's going to have to continue to be capital investments made in the infrastructure. The state of California, not to digress, but they have a program between Oakland and Sacramento called the Capital Corridor. They have 16 daily round trips on that corridor, which is phenomenal. It's phenomenal that they started in 1992, about the same time that this program started, and with two daily round trips, and they maxed out at 16, and they've achieved their vision. But they made a lot of capital investments along the way and developed a really strong partnership with the railroad. And I think they have a wonderful vision for this corridor here, and you're just on the precipice of greatness.
That's very nice to hear. And I see, you know, you at a slide way back when we looked at the corridor, you know, there's Eugene North, yeah, and then there's a blank spot until we get to California. Is there ever a time when we're going to complete that corridor? I know that I'm very, very familiar with the Kuciski line, Mr. Gard. I know what it would take.
Chair McEwen, success breeds success, and if we can save what we have and continue to grow it, I would say that anything is possible in the future.
All right.
That's my optimistic point.
Well, if we don't have a vision, what do we have?
Precisely. So we're about out of time, and my partners in crime and our other presenters, I think, hit an awful lot of the high points. I think Mayor Piercy did a beautiful job of really talking about the fact that we do approach this as a state as a connected system, and that we're really trying to tie the entire state together and using our passenger rail really as a backbone for that inner city regional travel. She also touched on the modal centers and those desires, and we're actively doing that right now here in Salem. I've got Greyhound now using our rail station as a stop. We tie in Valley Retriever so that we're connecting the coast, and we're connecting Bend, and we're continuing to expand those opportunities as they come along. So we really are thinking about the connected system. Let me talk about the hard pieces. We've got an unusual ask for a transportation department of $10 million in general fund. And that is really a reflection of some of the challenges we have with how we pay for public transportation in this state. It was mentioned, it's the lawnmower fund in our vanity license plates. When we have an increase in cost because of either changes in federal legislation or the need to acquire equipment, we don't have very many places to look to cover those costs. And I think that's really a conversation for this body and not really for my shop to figure out how we want to continue to do those. That $10 million ask, it's not a frivolous ask, and I recognize that. And we did everything we knew how to do to buy that down. It started out at 22.6. We sharpened our pencils. We went to school. We found one-time funding. We eliminated studies and things that would help us grow in the future to buy that down. And it's a need. It's an honest and real need. So I'm just saying, last year, I don't think I could have designed a better storm for poor ridership. We had a huge deep cut in fuel prices. We had awful on-time performance issues for a variety of reasons, both our schedule change, but also maintenance of work from UP. And our schedule change did not pan out the way we planned it at all. So that's on me. The on-time performance, I have to give our freight rail partners a lot of credit. When Ron and I squawked loudly, we got some results, and our on-time performance is now, this past month, it's up above 90%. And, you know, we need to do everything we can to keep it there. There's not much I can do about fuel prices, but our trend in ridership growth has been continuous since we established the service. And I think we can really look at this year as an anomaly, a dip, and I know that we can recover it if we make smart decisions in terms of our schedules and other pieces. Vice Chair Gorsuch asked a couple of really good questions, and I wanted to respond to those. The old Pioneer service right now, that corridor is currently covered by Greyhound, and we do not want to compete with private carriers where we don't need to. So our inner city and our rural lifeline routes, we establish those where there isn't service and try to tie those together. The public-private partnership, we do that routinely. So I have no source of money to leverage any federal grants. It doesn't exist for me. So when we have Tiger Grant opportunities, federal Tiger Grants, we actively work with the private carriers and actually get them to put in a match. So we're pursuing Tiger 7 opportunities now to remove one of the bottlenecks that will benefit directly passenger rail in North Portland. And UP has agreed to provide the 20% match on that project. So that's one example. Currently, the UP line through the valley, with very few exceptions, I think we've removed them all, is now a 79-mile-an-hour line from Eugene to Salem. That is a result of Connect Oregon funding that we put in place. We removed a big bottleneck on Harrisburg Bridge, which is a 30-mile-an-hour bridge. It's now 79-mile-an-hour bridge for passenger rail. So we pursue every opportunity. We turn over every rock we possibly can to underfunding. And with that, I'll conclude my remarks.
Thank you. Thank you for your good work. Representative McLean.
Well, I really appreciate the report and the update on all of the work in the last year to 2 years and the project on some of the federal funding partnerships. And to me, you know, this is such a major part of what a real multimodal system really is. And so it seems really apparent that if you lose track or you lose right away or you lose a corridor and some of the rights that you have for being an owner of a corridor, that you can't start it all over, not in this day and age, and not with the funding and the kind of money that it takes to even maintain and or run them. And so it seems very important to put this in this transportation package concept, whether it's this year, next year, or any year, that we have to keep this to be a major part of it. And so I just want to say that as a supportive member of this committee, of someone who really wants to help you figure out and help us figure out specifically how we can help maintain this as a vital part of our transportation system in the corridor and in the state of Oregon. So I'm hoping to help and be part of that work. And more information, anything else you can give us, we can always give it to our administrator, and we're happy to add it.
Thank you. Yes, Representative
sure.
Lively.
So I noticed on a couple of slides this term significant curvatures, and I wasn't sure, is that a positive because it's beautiful terrain, or is that a negative from a cost standpoint of infrastructure?
It could be a positive and a negative. I would love the train to ride to see like Puget Sound and the countryside through the Northwest, which we live in and we love. Mm-hmm. But it can be a negative for trying to get those speeds up through a curve.
That's what I assume.
But the Talgo train sets, that does allow some tilting technology to help us navigate through those trains, those curves a little
bit better. That's what I heard. Thank you.
You know, that begs a question. So if you're using a train set that's not Talgo, then are the speeds different than if they are going through that particular area?
So I can tell you this. We did look at the new bi-level cars because I'm part of the NGEC, the Next Generation Equipment Committee. The new bi-level cars, it's a term they call cant deficiency of what a train, how it can go through a curve and navigate through a curve. We believe those cars at a 79-mile-an-hour speed would probably be acceptable the way they're being designed, but they're not on the market. They're not out yet. Some states have put orders in for them, but we haven't because we've got a different type of train set model here.
And that begs another question now that you've opened that door.
Sure.
In the future, fueling. And I know there are some hybrid locomotives that have been developed. LNG fueling is a topic of conversation. Where do you see us going in that regard in the area of fueling in the future?
So on one of my slides, there was a cool little picture of the new locomotives Washington's getting with the federal funds. We're buying 8 Tier 4 locomotives. Those locomotives will require urea, a component to make them very clean. So we're going to be working with Amtrak as part of that federal investment of where that material will be stored, whether it's in Seattle, maybe some of it might be in Eugene for a turnaround service. We don't know yet, but we're evaluating that as part of this option. But those locomotives will start showing up in 2016. My hope is we can have the school banners on them or something, you know, Duck One, Husky One, which... Mm-hmm. I'm a Husky by 4.
Just come, don't run to Eugene.
I have to tell you, when I saw that picture with the ducks, I thought, we need a beaver slide and we need a Husky slide, or we're going to be in all kinds of hot water here. So we need trains going all directions with all colors at some point.
Right, there you go. But you could.
We have planes that do that. We need locomotives that do that.
That's right, or Alaska.
Yeah, I actually saw a hybrid locomotive working down at the Port of LA Long Beach not too long ago, and it was one of the first ones that came off the line, and they were struggling with it a bit. It was a brand new, well, it was 2 years old, but they were waiting for the next generation to come out because it wasn't quite perfected yet. But it was my understanding they're very interested in pursuing that technology. Other questions for this panel? All right. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being here today. It's a fascinating topic, and particularly for this committee, I'm delighted that you were willing to give us your time this afternoon.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
You bet. Is there anyone else that would like to speak to us this afternoon regarding passenger rail? All right. Well, and then on that regard, I believe we are. Then on that regard, I believe we are. Well, and